Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You're with Talk, we're on TV, we're on radio, we're online, and of course we're on your smart speaker as well. Coming up, the Prime Minister's policy of sending migrants to Rwanda faces further delays. Who'd have guessed it, as Labour vows to oppose the plans in a crucial vote tomorrow. They claim each deportation will cost as much as sending six people to space. I know who I'd send. Plus, eco-nuts are eliminated, as police will no longer be an acceptable defence for vandalism. Common sense at last. And gone to pot. Road repairs are at record highs amidst warnings. Our highways are heading towards breaking point. Good evening, Britain, and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, right here at Talk TV. Get ready for another blockbuster of a show, because I'll be telling you who's behind the net zero revolution and why they're so desperate to scare us all. I'll be explaining how your local council wants to treat drivers as wallets on four wheels. And we'll bring you Labour Chancellor in waiting, Rachel Reeves, with a policy speech without, guess what, any policy. Brilliant. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Let's get ready to rumble. The next episode in the never-ending soap opera that is the Safety of Rwanda Bill is coming to a House of Lords near you on Wednesday. Yep, tomorrow peers will have another swipe at the legislation that they sought to shackle with 10 amendments last week and the MPs voted down late last night. Hard to believe, isn't it, that we're still talking about Rwanda and yet nothing is going on. If you could collectively just add up all the words that have been spoken about it and maybe get a pound for every one of them, maybe the government would actually not be in deficit anymore. My panel are here with me tonight, Deputy Political Editor of The Sun, Ryan Sabey, journalist and broadcaster Emma Wolfe, and political analyst Mike Indian. Very good evening to all of you. I mean, we were told last night, early doors, that all 10 House of Lords amendments would be knocked down. They were all knocked down. Seemed to be a colossal waste of time. Some people seem to think it was a good idea that the House of Lords had a look. Now they're going to have another look, and Labour peers now are saying that they're going to block it. So, you know, how much more of this are we supposed to take, Ryan?
It could go on and it could be all done and dusted tomorrow. I doubt it will be. The likelihood is we'll have, as the well-known phrase, ping-pong, going between the Commons and the House of Lords.
It's more like whiff-waff, isn't it?
It is a little bit. As it literally travels that...
Wibble-wibble.
Exactly. That piece of legislation goes from the Commons to the Lords. It's about 50 yards, and there's that great ceremony that goes in between. What I think will happen tomorrow is you'll have the Lords voting and probably accepting... six or seven amendments.
Yeah.
The reason is that it will be up to the Tory peers. They have to get enough people in to vote it down.
Yeah.
They've called these people up from all around the world. Mm. You know, you are a Tory peer. You need to be here on this day. They may not get enough.
Yeah. There's not enough of them, is there?
There is just about, if they all turn up. Mm. However, some have got on business, some are ill. You've got to call them all in. So I think you'll have six or seven will go through. And one of the reasons it may go through is there won't be enough sort of One Nation Tories ready to give in just yet.
Right.
So I think when they do, the bill will go through and it'll be a
problem. There's plenty of Tories that still don't think the Rwanda bill is a good bill. And there's plenty of Tories who will rebel, I presume, in the House of Lords. But everyone keeps telling me that this is just like 1979. You know, I remember 1979. I mean, you guys might not because you don't look old enough. But, you know, 1979, when we'd had such terrible, terrible times with the Labour government and such awful times with, you know, rubbish piling up and you know, all sorts of strikes everywhere. You couldn't bury your dead and all of that, you know. But we keep getting references to it. And I remember the last time they had House of Lords in this situation where they were sort of shipping lords in from hospitals and, you know, bringing people in on stretchers.
Getting them out of the morgues.
You know, right. So, I mean, are we going back to the 70s? I mean, it was a pretty bad time.
I don't know if we're going back to the 70s, but this whole deportation, this farce just has to stop. This is weird that every... Rishi Sunak, every time he mentions Rwanda, we're just reminded of how utterly incompetent the Home Office has been under 14 years of his you know, party's rule. We've also found out this week that Rwanda are not even ready for this, right? They've only got 150 beds in the Hope Hostel. So the idea that they could make any dent in our backlog of hundreds of thousands of migrants.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole policy is a joke, and yet Rishi Sunak has chosen this as the hill on which he's going to die. He's obsessed with this.
No,
he's completely fixated on it. Rwanda is a byword. Mm. Well, it's a joke. It's a byword for failure.
Even people who might politically be on his side might say that he's obsessed with Rwanda and obsessed with a tiny, tiny problem of our entire immigration system. As Emma says, you know,
it's not... The utility of the policy is not worth the outcome. And, you know, in answer to your question about the return to the 70s, the Callaghan government didn't have a working majority at that point. They lost their vote of confidence in 1979 by one vote, famously. Rishi Sunak has a comfortable working majority. He proved that on Monday night, despite the recent by-election losses. He still has a working majority of 50-odd seats in the House.
He started with 80.
But he doesn't behave like a prime minister who's in control. We've had at least two of his prominent rivals in cabinet having to go out and publicly say in the press they are not out to try and oust him before the election. Penny Mordaunt, Kemi Badenoch. Mm. So Rishi Sunak doesn't behave like a man who has a working majority, but he feels like the last days of the John Major government feels a bit febrile. And this is why he's so desperate to get Rwanda through, because he's put so much credibility on it.
Would it not then be equally ridiculous, though, if he did? Because it wouldn't make any difference to his likelihood of winning at the
polls. It's going to make zero difference. It's not going to shift him in the polls. No one out there is saying, oh, well, if one flight takes off in May, or maybe June now.
Right.
And also, Mike, on a more serious note, I think there should be a public inquiry about this. I know we talk about a lot of government wastage and things. Apparently the cost is up to like 370 million. I think it is disgusting and scandalous, and I don't have the words for how awful it is that we have wasted this much money on possibly deporting 150 people, possibly a few more hundred, whatever it ends up being. Mm. The cost will have been absolutely ludicrous.
Yes, and like a lot of these scandals, an awful lot of people are getting very wealthy as a result. You know, not least quite a few Tory donors.
Government
not
lawyers.
Least the people that run Serco. Not least government contractors. Not least, you know, the people traffickers. I mean, everyone's getting rich on this business, apart from us.
Yeah, there's the people who run, like, Bibby Stockholm, or they've got the contracts, or they've got, you know, they're building the accommodation in these large camps, wherever they are. They're turning these RAF bases around. So people are making... I think the government, what they're trying to do, there's big numbers, 370-odd million they've spent so far. It is a huge, huge amount.
Yeah.
However, they think if this Rwanda policy acts as a deterrent, it'll bring down the overall bill of the hotels.
Yeah, but it won't, though, will it?
Acting as a deterrent, because they're not idiots. People traffickers can see that we're in utter disarray over this. I mean,
only last week we were saying that they were going to offer them $3,000 to go to Rwanda voluntarily.
Voluntarily.
You know, which is actually an intrinsic kind of invitation to come here, isn't it? You know, it's not like come here and you'll be threatened with being sent to Rwanda.
But this
it's like come here and we'll send you there and pay you $3,000.
And at the same time, as we send over maybe 30 will go, we also have to take people back from Rwanda.
Right. The whole business of immigration.
This is taxpayers' money.
But let me ask you, Mike, the whole business of immigration is knackered in this country. What are Labour going to do? We've got Rachel Reeves speaking tonight about how she's going to turn herself into Margaret Thatcher and presumably just upset lots of people in the Labour Party by saying that.
Momentum,
but basically, you know, we know that she's not Margaret Thatcher. We know that she's not necessarily going to do anything to change pretty much what is government policy and Treasury policy right now. But what would they do on immigration?
If I was Yvette Cooper, day one, it's having a real commission into the whole immigration system, not just looking at what happened
with
Rwanda. The whole point is we need a route to stem... root and branch review of the whole thing. It's not just looking at asylum policy and things. It's not just looking at immigration. It's looking at the whole round and how it operates.
And dismantling the Home Office and starting again.
Well, it doesn't take long to do an investigation into how useless the Home Office is. It's just useless.
Yes, but we need to look at how it's operating, what the outcomes are. Are we getting the people in for the professions that we need? How do we transition to more domestic
supply in the long term? But that would just take ages, wouldn't it? That would just be months and months.
If we get it right, though, we meant to have sorted this with Brexit. We didn't. Let's try and get it right now. If immigration's at a record high, we want to bring it down. We have to look at what the system is doing, what the outputs are, and where the points of pressure are.
It doesn't matter what Rachel Reeves said in her stupid Mays speech tonight.
We'll hear a bit of it later on, just so
you're happy about that. The Mays speech that I've never heard of. Because they can't lose. I mean, literally, she could stand
well,
up.
Listen, and... if Keir Starmer's still in charge, they can lose. Trust me.
Yeah, you know, they can lose.
You know, he is
okay.
not a shoo-in.
The Conservatives and Reform together would have to pull an
so Labour
absolute...
winning is not a Labour winning elections is very much a novelty, you know.
It's, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to
align
vote.
In
I don't
a
think anyone's
going to
vote
to win elections,
for anyone.
You know?
Yeah. But I think that Labour are pretty much a shoo-in for yeah. the next election.
I mean, you know about cephalogy, Ryan. I mean, at what point would this be the lowest turnout in a general election? I mean, I don't know whether there have been historically very low turnouts.
I'm trying to think election. What it would be now. I think if it got down to sort of into the 50s yeah. or early 60s.
I just wonder if that might be
yeah,
the thing that saved
a low point.
It was 55% in 2001 when yeah. Blair was pretty much a shoo-in.
No, but it won't yeah. save the Tories because Tories aren't going to vote, whereas at least Labour people are going to turn out and vote.
No, but will it save them from being wiped out, is I suppose what I'm saying.
It possibly, but you look at their core vote. That core vote for the Conservative Party was always around 30%. You're now going down to sort of mid-20s.
Yeah.
I mean, are they going to get enough people out to actually save... You know, they could be left with a real rump of about, you know, 100, 150 seats. We had that poll that out the other day in the Mail on Sunday saying Labour could get a majority of yeah. 250 seats.
Yep.
This is far beyond what yeah. Rishi Sunak can save. The only hope is that by shining a light on Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves during the election campaign, that you pull some of it back. But we're talking maybe a few dozen seats here
yeah.
or there.
Yeah, well, let's see. I don't know if we could get a flavour of what Rachel Reeves said tonight. We'll have a look at it in a moment. But, I mean, the thing that I think will happen if the Labour Party win a massive majority is that they will all start getting sort of power-crazed and the whole party will suddenly start rowing as the Tories have been rowing. Because if you look at how many factions there are inside Labour right now, you know, they can't even agree on what to do about Gaza. You know, David Lammy was up again today shouting and screaming about a humanitarian ceasefire, you know, not bothering to mention that Hamas keeps nicking all the aid that goes in, you know, but there's plenty of people who don't think he's going far enough. Let's have a look at Rachel Reeves and see if we can be inspired by anything she said.
I suggest that the answer to today is an economic approach which recognises how our world has changed. Building growth on strong and secure foundations with active government guided by three imperatives. First, guaranteeing stability. Second, stimulating investment through partnership with business. And third, reform. To unlock the contribution of working people and the untapped potential throughout our economy.
As George Galloway would say, I hope you didn't rehearse that speech. I mean, is that the best of it, you know?
I think they're...
Partnership with business for investment.
Wow.
Brilliant. Fantastic.
I think they're just going to have to put some more flesh on the bone when it yeah. comes to that election. I think what the thing is about this speech is a very sort of broad brush approach. It's not looking at the detail. There's no real tax... There's nothing on sort of tax and spend
there's nothing,
in terms of the detail. That's because they're trying to hold back and, you know, they are trying to work on growth, but it's how you actually get there.
Yeah.
It's all very well, the Conservatives and Labour talking about productivity, growth, these key phrases, but actually having a roadmap to actually yeah. getting there is
very
difficult.
But this is what I mean. If they get in with a big majority, you know, there will be people knocking on the door of her Chancellor's office going, this is what we need money for, this is what we need money
but
for.
But conversely, a big majority means they could ignore the lunatics inside the party. It's a smaller majority you actually had to worry more about because the Socialist Campaign Group makes up roughly 40 of the Labour MPs at the moment, about a fifth of the parliamentary
yeah.
party. And if you have a majority in, say, 40 seats or less, suddenly they have a lot more influence over whether Labour's budgets get through, its speeches get through.
Right.
So actually a bigger majority could actually put them in more of a secure
right.
position.
Also, let's not forget, since Rochdale, we haven't really talked that much about the effect that similar sort of campaigns to George Galloway's could have in, you know, in those particular constituencies where there happens to be a big Muslim majority of people.
Yeah, there's that. And also, I think you'll have, like, the Green Party in particular could take a lot of votes from Labour. They will be campaigning in particularly sort of student areas,
yeah.
those metropolitan areas, and saying, look at Labour. They didn't, you know, go through with their £28 billion
right.
green jobs plan. We'll have
right.
some of your votes.
And
you
also,
know,
the Gaza thing
could work
is,
like
a big,
that.
Is a big number as well, as it is in America with Joe Biden. You know, Joe Biden is getting hammered by the young university students who would normally vote Democrat and who would normally vote for him because they're in their 20s, because they don't like his attitude on Gaza. They don't like US policy on Gaza. And that could still be an issue here.
Yeah, I still think it's probably only going to cost you a few seats here or there. Again, with the Green thing, it's probably only going to cost you that much. I think if they can go for the centre ground, and this is what they're doing, they're tending to match the Conservatives on spending and their sort of fiscal rules. And I think if they do that, a lot of the country will think, well...
And that was what Reeves did say tonight. She committed to having debt falling at the end of the parliament, which is a huge constraint on public spending. So big strokes, we're not going to see a spending push as she's in the Treasury, which for Labour generates a bigger thing. She either has to get the economy growing and keep public spending as it is. With the NHS welfare, everything is social care at breaking point. That's a huge challenge for a party that's traditionally been the party of public services in this country.
Well, and that's the problem. For everything that everyone says about, you know, the NHS and the lack of funding for public services and local councils, you know, the government has never been bigger. I can't remember a bigger government in my entire career, and in fact, my life.
Yeah, then you've got the unions. Unite came out tonight and said that the plan, they need, you need to sort of take off the shackles when it comes to spending and reform, you know, saying some of the policies in the speech or some of the ideas are for the birds. Mm. So you've got the unions who will be knocking on the door asking for more money.
And so far, the only real magic money tree has been the non-dom thing, hasn't it? Which the
Conservatives have taken away. And also you've got the VAT on private school fees. Which is only going to raise 1.7, maybe £2 billion. Yeah. So it's not massive
that
in the
scheme
of things.
That won't keep you in illegal migrants for more than about, a couple of months?
Ten minutes, I'd have thought.
You know, exactly right. And also, they're actually attacking something that many people who might vote Labour as a sort of Blairite Labour would be sending their kids to those schools.
And look, that private school thing is a red herring because it could end up costing them a lot more when, you know, everybody then migrates to the state school system.
Exactly
right. Massive pressure on the state school system. So.
And plenty of educationalists will say it also, in a way, undermines the plan to get everybody into a decent school, because what you'll get is the people who can't now afford to put their kids into private school putting their kids into decent secondary schools, and the poorer kids won't have the chance.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, it's
not very Labour
to play for, not very Labour at all. Mind you, that's how they have to be to get in, isn't it?
Of course, they're doing a Tony Blair and tacking to the centre.
Yeah. You know, it makes you harken back to the good old days of Tony Blair, a man with principles compared to what they've got now.
But also on the schools, you've got the catchment areas. So if these people, you know, who can afford school fees, you can say, well, actually, this I can save a hell of a lot of money. We'll buy a nice house in the catchment area and then push people who are,
but that's exactly what happened.
I feel like you're looking at me.
Yeah, that's exactly what will happen. But anyway, listen, guys, good start. We'll get you back to talk about a great many other things, of course. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. After the break, we look at the tablecloth that has been pulled from under the feet of the eco-nutters. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, finally, some common sense, as the Court of Appeal has banned the excuse that fear of the climate crisis is a legitimate belief. Yes, in a blow to the woke eco-maniacs everywhere, this last line of defence that has got them all off jail time and time again has now been confined to the history books. Joining me live right now is former commander of Specialist Operations, Mr. Roy Ram. Roy, very good evening to you. Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Some of these eco-nutters have been just literally taking the mickey out of the police, out of the law, out of the judicial system for ages and ages and ages. We saw them time and time again, you know, getting pulled off the M25, being taken to the police station, being released, and then going straight back to the M25. So is this as significant a manoeuvre and a decision as I'd like to think it is?
Yeah, it's very important, Mike. You know, and credit to the Attorney General for looking at it following the acquittal of demonstrators who sort of said, well, you know, if you'd known how important the issue was that caused me to chuck paint all over your premises, you'd have been okay with it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it was an absurd decision at that court level. So when the AG took it to the Court of Appeal, and we've got this judgment now, which is, as you rightly said, I mean, it's just common sense. You cannot give protesters this absurd license where they say, well, you know, I've damaged your building by chucking paint over it, or I've slashed your paintings in a gallery because, you know what, I've got this very strong political or philosophical belief that kind of legitimises my actions. You know, I think it doesn't need a lawyer to see how stupid it was.
Well, exactly right. You might as well start robbing banks and saying, you know, I've got a sort of, you know, a thing against capitalism, so that means that I can rob banks with impunity and I can get off with it.
Yeah, I met a few robbers in my time, and the redistribution of wealth as a philosophical defence was not one that was ever raised, but the spectre of it is quite fearful. But, I mean, you know, getting back to the point of the day, we have to see proper judgments closing down some of these activities which cause enormous distress to most of the public and cause damage to property. It's just not acceptable.
No, and also because, of course, we've heard from them recently that they're going to have different tactics this year. The Just Stop All Brigade last month said they're going to start protesting outside people's homes. We've seen a couple of them being arrested for delivering letters to individual homes of individual MPs. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, I know they say, oh, we're only doing what the postman does. That's intimidatory behaviour. If you're a politician and you've got people turning up outside your house where your family live, I don't think that's acceptable.
No, I think that's right. And you know, you have to look at the wider context of it. Okay, people go into politics and I think, you know, a thick skin is something that's required. But everybody's entitled to a home life and to enjoy the quiet enjoyment of their homes. And, you know, people, MPs like all of us, got wives, families, husbands, and children. And it's not right to focus on their personal lives for what's going on in their professional life. Westminster is the place to lobby, all right, you know, ask to go and see them in their constituency offices. But I think that, you know, private addresses should absolutely be, you know, off the radar. Mm.
Well, as I say, it was only, I think, last week that one of those Just Stop All regulars, Phoebe somebody or other, who comes from a very posh family and went to a £41,000 a year sponsored private school, she was arrested for taking a letter to Emily Thornberry's house. But today, and I think we've got a little bit of footage of this, more of them then went and attacked Emily Thornberry at a public meeting that she was at. I think we can have a look at it.
I'm very thankful for our panel. Our government not acting as it should. In 2020, Emily Thornberry said that we have no time for cowardice in the face of the climate crisis. And yet, at this crucial historic moment, Labour are rolling back their commitments to the climate. We need Labour to be brave, to not be cowardly at this moment. We need you to make a commitment at this moment to revoke the Tory licences for new oil and gas infrastructure that will lock us on to the worst pathways of global warming and climate catastrophe.
Labour need to wake up and smell the coffee.
So there we are, you know, yet another exhibition of complete and utter tomfoolery. And basically, these two characters from Just Stop Oil, now they're throwing orange confetti because it's slightly better than throwing paint, I suppose. But they're disrupting a meeting. Nobody really wants them there. And they're basically demanding that Emily Thornberry cancels her membership of the Labour Party and commits to leaving it because they're not going to cancel Tory oil and gas licences that have been put out. But you'll love this one, Roy, because guess what their names are? Casper and Genevieve.
Right. Well, yeah, you know, Casper and Genevieve, I think what they do at events, when they behave like that, you know, at public events, they risk generating a backlash from people who are there to listen to legitimate arguments. And it's the kind of behaviour that it invites challenge and invites them getting thrown out, perhaps, you know, not necessarily by the conference organisers, but other people that are there. And it's just, it's inviting disorder. And I think, you know, it kind of undermines the strength of their arguments. Mm. And I don't think they see that.
Right. And do you think this might change now the way perhaps that the police operate when they're trying to deal with these guys? Because we know that they were given sort of better powers towards the back end of last year to police their demonstrations. And when they were trying to walk slowly, the police seemed to be getting a bit better at dealing with them. Will this help the police, you think?
Yeah, I think it will. You know, I think we police by consent. That's been something that's been around since 1839. But, you know, it's the consent of the broader public. And I think that the consent of the broader public was undermined. It was being lost because the police were seen to have been too soft, not forceful enough. And I think you will see a more robust, more direct police activity over this coming summer.
Yeah. And if that gives them the opportunity to be more robust, then it gives them the sort of license, if you like, and permission, if you like, to do that. I think a lot of people will have their faith restored in the police.
I think you're right. You know, I think that when you go into central London, I went in a few times during various protests to see other events or to, you know, go to theatre or whatever, and to see the streets being taken over in the way that they were and the kind of activity that was going on and was being ignored or tolerated, it was quite upsetting, actually, to see London in that state. And I think that ordinary people who want to go do their shopping in Oxford Street, go to the parks, go about their business, don't want to see it continually disrupted week in, week out by these kinds of protests.
Yeah, exactly right. Because the fact is that the rules of engagement are not really fit for purpose now, because if you have, for example, one of these Palestinian marches every single Saturday for 24 weeks, as we have just had, you know, that is not the same as an ordinary protest that would happen once in a while or once a year or, you know, on May Day or something like that, you know. So we need to have, surely, a better way of dealing with those kinds of events.
Well, I think you need that for a number of reasons, not least of which is the abstraction of police staff. You know, we've seen this week that I think it's 60 detectives are being taken off of murder squads to save money, to try and get the Met to meet its budget. Spent over £30 million policing these demonstrations, and that impacts on every community in London. You know, where you should have police officers out investigating major crime, investigating burglaries, giving public reassurance, they're spending all weekend walking around central London. And ironically, you know, when you look at something like the reduction of police officers on murder squads, the people that will be out there calling for justice for victims are very much, a lot of them, the same people that are out there demonstrating and taking police resource away right now.
Yeah, exactly right. Roy, good to talk to you. Thanks very much indeed. Roy Ram there telling us his ideas of why the police should be able to be more empowered now by this particular scenario. He's former commander of specialist operations at the police, of course. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Next up, we're going to look at Labour's lecture of little content and Starmer's ULEZ U-turn. Stay exactly where you are. Thank you. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. And now, earlier this evening, Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves announced that she's entering her Maggie Thatcher era as she promises to go hard on the economy if elected. And that's looking like a strong possibility at the moment, despite Rishi Sunak's best efforts. But can you really trust Labour to deliver a strong and stable economy? Well, I wouldn't be able to give you a yes on that one. But to give her a take on this very question, I'm now joined down the line by former government advisor Claire Pearsall. Claire, very good evening to you. Welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. I'm not so sure about Rachel Reeves. She talks a good game. She manages to make an entire speech about economic policy without mentioning any actual economic policy. And is Labour really so confident about getting into power that they can even mention the name Margaret Thatcher?
Well, it does seem as if they're looking at the Conservatives for all of their economic policies going forward. When you think about what it is Rachel Reeves has actually put forward, it is no different to Rishi Sunak when he was Chancellor, investments that Margaret Thatcher wanted to make, you know, encouraging businesses to invest, the private sector working alongside government, improving tech skills, which was a big one from Rishi Sunak, and cementing Britain's position as an innovative economy. So all I think she's done is take the really interesting and good parts of what the Conservatives have done over the decades and added a few words, but no specifics to what Labour would actually do different and why it would work differently.
Yes. And it seems to me that, you know, with all of these comparisons going on about whether this is like 1979 or whether it's like 1997, you know, Thatcher was able to unleash the power of the sort of financial services industry, which previously didn't exist. She was able to offer, you know, people the ability to buy their own council homes. She was able to offer people shares in companies that were publicly owned and all of that. Blair, by contrast, was able to kind of completely change and revolutionise the way we all lived. He brought the digital age to Britain and all of that. You know, I don't see any of those kinds of opportunities for Keir Starmer to suddenly change the way we live.
No, and of course, we mustn't forget that one of Labour's big policies was, of course, this green revolution. Whether you agree with it or not,
I
they
don't.
Wanted to put I didn't think you did. And I'm with you on this. £28.5 billion was meant to go into the green economy. Well, what was that coming from? And now they've had to U-turn on it. So their fiscal policy has basically fallen apart over just one pledge. Mm. So I think it's down to about $4.7 billion now. So I think we're starting to see these things eke away. And of course, there was the great non-dom tax status, which Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor, has removed away already. So that also leaves a massive hole of $2.7 billion in Labour spending fees.
Yeah, and the other problem they're going to have is the immense amount of money that currently this government's spending on illegal migrants coming into the country. Billions and billions of pounds. It seems to double about every sort of 3 to 6 months. I mean, God knows what it's going to be like by the time we get to the end of 2024.
Well, quite interesting. I think it will indefinitely increase. There are no plans realistically from Labour as to what they would do with migration or what they want their policies to look like. And if they do come up with a policy, it hasn't been costed. So I think that we would all be so much worse off, especially if they start looking to open up the borders even further to Palestinians fleeing conflict. You know, they seem to want to let the world in and have someone else pay for it, which is always the problem you have with a Labour government.
Yes. And of course, I was saying this earlier to the panel that, you know, it's been such a long time since they've been in government. If they do win a big majority, which I'm not entirely certain that they will do. By the way, Harry Cole has apparently tweeted out tonight that he thinks the election is going to be on October the 17th. We'll see about that. But I wonder whether they've actually got the cojones or the kind of stamina to set up a government, because they'll be so thrilled to be in there. They'll be so amazed that they've got a majority. There'll be so many factions of the party fighting with each other for who gets what and how much money can the Treasury give for all their pet projects. I think it'll be chaos.
Well, it will. And that's always the difficult lesson that opposition parties have to learn. When you get into government, you have to make some real and hard choices. So all of the things that you've promised throughout your election campaign, you suddenly have to be responsible for. Mm. And as we've seen from Keir Starmer, he's not very keen on making an actual decision and sticking to it. And when you're running the country, you have to. You have to sometimes be unpopular. You have problems within your own party that you've got to battle. And then you'll have a very, very noisy opposition who are looking to pick holes in anything that you come forward with.
Right. And, I mean, you've been a government advisor. You've been behind the curtain, if you like. I mean, what is it going to be like in there at the moment? Because we see Rishi Sunak kind of stumbling from day to day. I mean, I started my show yesterday in which I actually said, you know, Rishi Sunak survives another day, because it feels like every day is another miracle. You know, it must be pretty down sort of trodden inside of Downing Street and inside of any government department where you've got special advisors trying to cheer everybody up.
Yeah, I mean, it will be really difficult. Most departments are going to be under enormous pressure. I've been out of a government department for a little bit of time, but I work in Westminster. I was there today, and the mood just feels really flat.
Yeah.
Especially Conservative MPs who are wandering around thinking, why isn't this getting any better? This is just incredibly hard work, and wanting to concentrate on winning their own seat. But every single time they want to go out and talk to their constituents, there seems to be another problem coming straight at them. So it is incredibly miserable at the moment. I should imagine that in departments, there is enormous standoffs between civil servants and special advisors and ministers, because we don't know how long this parliament is going to go on for. So there really isn't going to be massive decisions made on spending.
No, exactly right. And I mean, that is the thing, isn't it? In terms of the way that the future is going to be for the Tory party. A lot of people are saying to me, well, let's see what happens at the local elections in May. If it's really bad for Rishi Sunak, that's when the proper plotting will really begin. But Madeleine Grant said to me from The Telegraph yesterday, you know, where is the low point? Because every time you think you've reached it, it gets even lower.
Yeah, and that's been the problem. Just when you think you've heard the most crazy idea or the most crazy conspiracy going around, out comes another one. Mm. And we've seen it over the weekend, and it just seems to be this endless round of decisions that are put out, communications that fall flat, leaving a vacuum for everybody to fill. So once you don't have a sort of proper comment coming out from Number 10, a really concrete decision on what's going to happen and what they actually mean, then it just gets into a real mess. And all you see are plotters sitting there working out how best they can position themselves, how best they can leak things to newspapers to make things even more difficult when they need to actually be coming together and working as a team, because the real enemy is the opposition, and that's who we have to beat.
Yes, exactly right. And still, talking of that front bench of the Labour Party, I still think there's an awful lot of people in this country who couldn't name you more than about three people sitting there. They could probably tell you who Keir Starmer is. They probably know who Angela Rayner is. They might even know David Lammy, but that's about it, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I think they'll probably recognise a few faces. They may not be able to put names to them, but that will change. It is a bit natural when you've got you've had an opposition there for 14 years that's chopped and changed and hasn't said anything very interesting. The only reason that opposition benches come to your attention is normally when there's been a problem or a little local difficulty being brought up in the newspaper. So I don't think that's unusual. They will have to set out their stall come the election campaign, which is what all MPs do anyway.
Absolutely. Claire, good to talk to you. Thanks very much indeed. I'm sure there's much more fun to be had over the course of the next few weeks. And if Harry Cole's right, and it is October the 17th, you better start strapping yourselves in because it's going to be a very bumpy ride, I'll tell you that. You're watching the Independent Republican Mike Graham. After the break, we'll look at the disgrace of Britain's roads, why councils as well want to fine you for driving on them. Heaven forbid. It's all coming next. Welcome back to the Independent Republican Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, it's time for Taking the Mic. Beware the Ides of March. It officially falls on March the 15th, so last Friday, actually. And it is traditionally the date in the Roman calendar that is associated with misfortune and doom. Now, what does that remind you of? Ah, yes, you've got it. The climate change nutters. And believe it or not, they're at it again. Not for them any good news this week, not for the eco-nuts, a recognition that people in this country and around the world have been shoehorned into life-changing practices and expenditure, all because they've told us we must deal with the climate emergency. But guess what? Apparently, it has all been in vain. All those electric cars, the heat pumps, the low-traffic neighbourhoods, the sustainable energy sources, the windmills, the low-emission zones, and even the veganism, all worthless, pointless, and utterly clueless. The World Meteorological Society, yeah, I didn't know it existed either. Apparently, it's the United Nations agency which does for the Green Brigade what the World Health Organization does for disease, i.e. doesn't stop it spreading, has warned today that we must sound a red alert about global warming. They say there are records being smashed all over the planet, increases in greenhouse gases, increases in land and water temperatures, and the melting of sea ice and glaciers. The WMO reckons that the world is failing to stop the planet warming up by 1.5 degrees Celsius. And even UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is joining in. He said the Earth's issuing a distress call. The latest state of the global climate report shows a planet on the brink. Well, we've been on the brink for bloody 50 years now, haven't we? Remember the greenhouse effect? Remember all those sprays that you couldn't use? So here we go again. The answer, of course, aside from more demands for us to spend more public money on yet more green policies, is to have, you guessed it, yet another climate conference. This one is in Denmark on Thursday and Friday, so look out for more private jets delivering climate experts and government ministers to Copenhagen. Meanwhile, back home, the Green Brigade here are at it as well. There's a thing called the Green Alliance, which is an eco think tank and charity. They're accusing Rishi Sunak of leaving a sorry legacy of delays and cancellations when it comes to the net zero targets. They say we are simply not doing enough. Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? Because they keep doing it. But let's have a look at just who backs these organisations. The Green Alliance is partnered with all kinds of foundations and is supported by a whole variety of companies. Included in their funding page are the National Trust, Southern Water, Greenpeace, the University of Sussex, Wessex Water, the Wildlife Trust, and the Reform of Social Change. These green nutters are absolutely everywhere, inveigling their way into governments, helping local authorities to punish car drivers, and using their power to influence private company policies. It's sinister, it's far from transparent, and it is just like a cult. But mostly, it's a multi-billion pound business and an awful lot of people are making an awful lot of money. Worst of all, everything we've been made to do to save the planet hasn't worked. So how about we just stop doing it? Fire up the quattro. Now, speaking of the Green Brigade, Britain's highways are heading for breaking point, according to a new report, with pothole repairs at an eight-year high. According to the Asphalt Industry Alliance, 2 million potholes are needed to be fixed, up 43% on the previous year. Talk Today correspondent Nick Ellaby has been out and about speaking to locals in one of the worst affected areas, and that's Chesterfield in Derbyshire.
Tell me about Chesterfield's potholes.
They're horrific at the moment, I've got to say. Every road you drive down, pothole, pothole, pothole after pothole, it's awful. Pretty sure the tracker in my car is gone because of them. They need to get sorted, really.
Tell me about the potholes in Chesterfield.
Just a genuine nightmare. There's like every single road has got potholes on. They're tyre eaters, they're alloy wheel killers. And they're just absolutely everywhere.
And have you had any damage to your car or anyone you know?
Yeah, actually, I work as part of the NHS, and one of the doctors had to call in once because he basically ruined all wishbones on his car and suspension, basically just ripped the entire lot out.
Have you or anyone you know damaged their car because of them?
Yeah. I know someone at work. She's gone through one and it's just punctured a tyre. She's had to write it to council and stuff.
I had a flat tyre last week.
From the poles?
Yeah, from the poles.
Have they been fixed?
No, I've reported it multiple times to the council and they've just done nothing. My family have tried reporting it and you just can't get through.
That'll be because they're all working from home. It comes as councils launch a new war on motorists, with dozens applying for the right to issue fines if drivers get caught in yellow boxes. You'd want to hope that some of that money will be put towards fixing the state of the roads, but it's probably unlikely, isn't it? Joining me now, though, is the man himself, Mr. Pothole, otherwise known as Mark Merrill. Mark, and very, very good evening. Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You and I have been talking about potholes for longer than I'd care to remember, but it has seemed to have reached kind of crisis point with all those people. You barely talk to anybody now who hasn't had some kind of damage to their car done because of a horrendous pothole.
Yeah, you're right. That Asphalt Industry Alliance report today saying that the backlog currently stands at £16.3 billion and worrying that in 15 years' time, 53% of our roads will be structurally failed. So this needs to be a turning point. I mean, unless government actually invest in an annual resurfacing program, and that needs to be a multi-billion pound year on year like other countries, you know, then we're going to end in a very sorry state. It's horrendous. I mean, yeah, Chesterfield, I get quite a few things in Derbyshire and around Chesterfield through my social media feeds. And, you know, the actual backlog got worse by £2.2 billion in 12 months.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? And tell us, because you're the expert here, exactly who is responsible for fixing potholes, because it might vary depending on where you are, right?
Yeah, local authorities generally for your local roads, and the motorways and national trunk roads are national highways. Now, this report only covers local roads. I've never seen the motorways and trunk roads in the condition they are. I had people sending me pictures of the M20 the other day with potholes on. I mean, you know, someone comes into the UK and they come onto our roads. I had a German guy contact me and said it was horrendous coming into the country.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly anyone who drives in continental Europe will say that the roads in every other country apart from this one are so much better than ours. But, of course, if you go to Spain, a lot of their roads were built by EU money, which we contributed to, and apparently we were too rich of a country to get any of that EU money, so our roads are now worse than Spain's.
Yeah, we're 37th in the world. The last one that was done in assessment was done in 2019 prior to the pandemic for a G7 nation. Places like Cyprus are above us.
Yeah, Cyprus, the roads are absolutely fantastic. I would say one or two things to you at this point, Mark. You know, clearly there's more vehicles on the roads than ever before because people are taking to the roads more often than not because it's now the cheapest form of travel, despite the fact that, you know, it's more and more expensive to drive. It's still cheaper than, say, taking four people on a train journey somewhere, you know, where you end up costing the family an absolute fortune. Also, I wonder how much of an effect very, very much heavier vehicles are having. I'm talking, of course, about electric vehicles, electric buses, electric lorries, electric vans, electric cars. They are very, very heavy. And I wonder how much of this damage is being caused because those vehicles are so heavy.
Yeah, it doesn't help. And also, you get the initial load from an electric motor through the wheels. It puts more stresses on the highway. Now, when you've got highways that have been neglected for decades that are cracking and crazy in them, it doesn't take a lot for the rain to get in there. And then them vehicles passing over, and they cause like a hydrostatic pressure, so like a wedge being driven in, into them, and the heavier the vehicle, more so. But it's a perfect storm. It's just been decades of underinvestment. It's not just the current government. It's previous governments. They've been ignored. Now it's come to a point where, you know, we've got an election coming up. I think everybody really needs to voice the situation to whoever wants their vote, whether it be local elections or national election, to say that as road users, we're paying over £50 billion a year into various taxation on our roads, and government currently only give £1.2 billion. And you'll get the Department of Transport say we're going to give an extra £8.3 billion over 11 years. That's enough to do 5,000 miles of road resurfacing. Let's put that in context. That's 2.5% of the road network in England and Wales.
Yeah.
Currently, 20% of our roads need resurfacing and major works. And as we know, you know, by we get in 15 years' time, it'd be 53%. You'd be talking sort of up to £100 billion.
Yeah, exactly right. And so there really should be some amount of money ring-fenced, shouldn't there, by local authorities, either whether it be from council tax or whether it be from the amount of money they get from central government, that they must spend on fixing these things. Because presumably the other problem we've got is that depending on which part of the country you're in, some of them get fixed better than others.
Yeah, I mean, the quality of repairs is an issue. There is some very good machinery like that Pothole Pro from JCB that drives better repairs. But I think we need to change the whole system, because at the moment, you know, we talk about road tax. Well, that also goes into the central exchequer. Other countries have a road tax and the money's spent on the roads. Mm. I mean, we need to change things. Doing the same thing the same way and expecting a different result is madness, I'm afraid. And I think we need to change the whole concept. 80% of it's about funding. The rest of it's about management, quality control, better materials, better training. The whole thing needs to be changed and the culture needs to be changed.
Yes. And I was talking to a friend of mine who lives in one of the southeast counties, who said that his local high street was dug up recently, and there's a contract that exists between the people doing the digging and the people kind of doing the coning off of the work, if you like. And if the people doing the digging stop earlier in the day, the people who are blocking the road with all the cones and the fences and everything else, they don't get paid a full day's work unless they stay there for the full day. So they keep the fences up even though the actual work is finished, which causes all manner of disruption and traffic jams. But also, when they took the stuff away, the hole wasn't properly filled in.
Yeah, I mean, utilities works. In the past, when councils had some more resources in there, they could police them. Because councils have cut successively on staff numbers, it means that the roads and the assets actually failing. I mean, you can find utilities, but you've got to catch them out. You've got to have a situation where you've got to be proactive. Yes, you might have to spend a little money in the first place, but there's revenues councils can get from finding utilities that underperform.
Yeah. Absolutely right. Mark Morrell, good to talk to you. Thanks very much indeed. Also known, of course, as Mr. Pothole. The problem gets worse and worse and worse. As I said, me and Mark have been talking about this for a very, very long time. And the pothole problem has always been very high in the minds of everybody who drives. Because if you've got insurance on your car, your insurance will go up if you hit a pothole and it needs repairing. And if you have got insurance on your car, some of it will not cover an accident caused by you hitting a pothole. So it's an absolute nightmare. And we'll be talking, I'm sure, lots more about it, because the Tory party are trying to tell us that they know that this is a problem for people and they're going to be helping them out. Really? Are they? Is it just another pipe dream? We shall see. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. At 9 o'clock, we're going to look at the lunacy of all of those Kate conspiracies. And Donald Trump is threatening to boot Prince Harry out of the USA. Please, God, don't send him back here. Let him stay where he is, and you stay where you are as well.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Good evening and welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You're with Talk, we're on TV, we're on radio, we're online, and of course we're on your smart speaker as well. Coming up, breaking news. Bosses at the hospital where Princess Kate had her operation are investigating a confidentiality breach. We'll bring you all those details very shortly. Plus, Donald Trump says Prince Harry should be deported over his past drug use, and the BBC plans to feature adverts in its radio output for the first time ever to rival its competitor stations. And now for the story at the top of the least surprising news of the week, department. Motorists are getting rinsed by local councils for minor traffic offences that are costing us millions. More than 10 million households now live in areas where councils have been given powers to hand out penalties to motorists as high as £105 a time. And we're not just talking about parking fines handed out by overzealous Jobsworths, who willingly spend each and every day making people's lives miserable. No, no, this is much worse. Because this means that traffic infractionis, which used to be the sole purview of the police, now become under the authority of your local council. And you know how they love a bit of authority. We're talking about fines for getting caught in a yellow box, making illegal U-turns, driving in a bus lane, making banned left or right turns, and going the wrong way up a one-way street. What's the problem, I hear you cry? If it's illegal, you should get a fine. Well, that would be okay if, in fact, you knew it was illegal. Just to explain, I've got fines for almost all of the above while driving in London, where local councils have had this right since 2003. And each time, I had no idea I was committing any offence. And that's not just because I'm a complete and utter idiot. When I was done for driving the wrong way up an unfamiliar street, I challenged the fine because the no-entry sign was so high up on a pole that it wasn't possible to see it. They refused my appeal, but the following week I went back to check and they'd lowered the sign to make it more visible by about 6 feet. And when I was fined for venturing into a yellow box for just a few seconds, just before an amber light turned green, because there was nowhere else to go other than to block a roundabout, I didn't bother appealing because sometimes it's easier just to pay the fine. And when I was fined for driving in a bus lane, my appeal that it was impossible to know it was a 50-yard long new bus lane while driving behind a bus, because there was only a sign on the surface of the road which is not visible to me, it was declined. The newly designed road was so confusing. But it was no excuse, apparently, even though they had built a wide pavement divider, which was previously not there. And when I was fined for making an illegal right turn in the West End, where the sign was barely visible in a busy street where signage was so confusing that there was about 50 signs on one pole, once again, my appeal was rejected. The roads in our cities now are so badly designed that most people who commit offences do so by accident. But there's rarely any forgiveness offered. 85 of England's 152 highway authorities now have this power, and you know what they're going to do. They'll buy more cameras and fine everyone more, because it's easy. More than 27 million potential drivers live in these areas. That's 59% of the population aged 16 and over. The trouble is, they hold all the cards. you'd better be prepared to fork out a few hundred quid a year because they're coming for you. Now, later on in the show, we'll be bringing you a first look at tomorrow's front pages. But before anyone else, we've got an exclusive look at the Metro newspaper, and they're going with a very unusual story, which we will pick up a little bit more from on the panel when the panel get back in. And it's basically the headline that says this: first cyber flasher jail. This is a ghastly individual called Nicholas Hawkes, a sex offender who sent naked images of himself to a 15-year-old girl and a woman who's aged 60. And he's basically become the first person in Britain to be convicted of cyber flashing. He sent the unsolicited photos from his phone. He was caught, he was tracked down, he was tried, and now he's going to have to go to jail. So that's a warning to anyone that would ever, ever get involved in anything like that. We'll bring you more, as I say, on that throughout the show. And also much later on when the panel returns, we'll have a lot more from the front pages and the other newspapers as well. Now, there's a breaking story that I want to bring you on Catherine Princess of Wales. It's been brought to us as an exclusive from the Mirror newspaper. It turns out that there's an investigation currently underway because while Kate, Princess of Wales, was a patient in the London clinic in January, at least one member of staff is said to have been caught trying to access her notes. And of course, bosses have launched a probe into these claims because breaching confidentiality is a very, very serious problem. And when she was in the London clinic, at least one member of staff was said to have tried to get a hold of them. The allegations have sent shockwaves through the hospital, which is in Marylebone in central London. It's got a very, very good reputation for discreetly treating members of the royal family, former presidents, prime ministers and various other celebrities. One insider says this is a major security breach and incredibly damaging for the hospital. And it's got a reputation for treating members of the royal family. We don't yet know whether the police have been involved and the police have been told, but this is a story exclusively being reported in the Daily Mirror. We'll bring you more on that when we get it. But let's speak, first of all, to host of To Die For Daily podcast, Kinsey Schofield. Kinsey, welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You know, we were shown yesterday the first pictures of William and Kate out shopping together. We'll get to those in a moment. First, let's talk about this incredible breaking news about this possible breach of confidentiality in what you might call the top people's clinic in London.
Mike, you and I have been concerned about this for the last 2 or 3 weeks. We have specifically said that the chaos that's been generated online could ultimately jeopardize the Princess of Wales's safety, her, you know, confidentiality right here. Mm. You're seeing somebody that has breached protocol for what? Social media clout? And I'm doing some research on my end because this is a breaking story. But what I can tell you is following some of the fallout online over the Princess of Wales and her health and the photo. There is a blogger that is located in Southern California. She has over 1 million followers on Instagram. She became popular through the Johnny Depp trial and has slowly eased her way into royal commentary. And she, there were claims on her social media that she had a contact within the hospital that gave her information about the Princess of Wales's health. And on her Instagram, I watched her apologize to the Princess of Wales because of this information she claims to have received from a member of staff at the hospital. So a part of me wonders if you've got over 1 million followers. That is a huge draw. Yeah. Could that announcement, could that social media activity have led to this investigation? I don't know. Mm. But as far as we know, through what's been reported so far, is someone only attempted to access those documents. There's no report so far that someone successfully accessed those documents about the Princess of Wales's private health concerns at this hospital. And it's like you said, I mean, the Kennedys were clients at this hospital. Yeah. Prince Philip, Princess Margaret, this is typically a very trusted venue for high-profile individuals. If this turns out to be true, what a disappointing experience for the Princess of Wales.
Absolutely right. And it is, in fact, a criminal offence for any member of staff in an NHS or even a private healthcare hospital to access medical records of a patient. It's not clear whether it's a criminal offence to attempt to. I suppose it would depend on the circumstances, but it's possible that it could be a criminal investigation, because if you're trying to access something which is illegal, then you are somehow committing a crime by doing so, aren't you?
I mean, if I'm trying to rob a bank, I hope that I'm going to jail for trying to rob a bank. So, I mean, I know that that's an extreme in comparison, but I think it's, if there's the intention there to break the law,
right,
surely somebody is going to be reprimanded for such a ridiculous activity. And again, Mike, I just can't stress enough, you and I have been worried about this, somebody chasing social media clout and doing, yes, something unethical in an attempt to gain that notoriety. And here we are.
Yes, exactly. Exactly right, because as we said last night when we were speaking about the whole situation with Kate and the pictures and what happened on Mother's Day and what subsequently happened over the weekend and what subsequently happened in The Sun today, you know, the trolls have still not stopped, because I think now the genie is so far out of the bottle, it's never going back in. And I think there are now people who are so obsessed with this story that no matter what evidence they see, they won't believe it.
Yeah, how much do you want to just tell those people to get a life? I mean, I'm having to bite my tongue here.
Yeah.
I know, I'm having to bite my tongue here, because I, you know, people are forwarding me these conspiracy videos and I just don't have time for this kind. It just seems so idiotic. I don't have time for this. There's not a big conspiracy. They were ridiculously open with us. The transparency at the beginning of this process was, hey, guess what? You are not going to see this woman until Easter. Mm. For some reason, that just was not a good enough excuse for the weirdos that you've seen cultivate huge audiences online by stirring the pot. I believe that the Princess of Wales is in recovery. I think she's doing well. I believe we're going to see her at Easter. And I wish everybody would just leave her the hell alone.
Yeah, exactly right. But I did say to you last night, and I mean, I didn't want it to come true, but I said, no doubt there will be people who immediately they see this video will say, oh, that's not her. But in fact, it now has been proven to be a genuine video. It has been examined by the people that do these kinds of things, and they have checked with facial images, they've checked all sorts of antecedents and editing buttons and whether anything was done, and it is a genuine video, and it would appear that they can prove that it is definitely the two of them together.
And it made somebody very, very rich, Mike. I mean,
yes,
this was all of the people complaining about it being a blurry photo. They grabbed a screenshot from a video that was taken. That's why the photo is blurry. This was likely, honestly, not a setup. Otherwise, I think you would have better quality. I think it was somebody creeping inside their car and they realized they hit the jackpot when they saw these two. Andy Cohen here, who is a huge personality, he's basically the head of Bravo, created the housewife franchises and probably polluted American television, if we really want to give him credit. But he has said there's no way that's Kate on Twitter. So you're even seeing some of these high profile individuals fall into the conversation, and it's just like completely unnecessary. Get a life.
Right.
I mean, don't you have some reality trash television to create over in this in your trash TV corner?
Right. Exactly right. Well, we've got a page from The Sun tomorrow morning, page 10. Arthur Edwards, very well-known, very famous royal photographer, has been doing it even longer than I was doing it for. Trolls claim it wasn't Kate, and Elvis has been spotted riding Shergar. You might not know what Shergar is. That was a horse that got kidnapped by the IRA and was never found again. And so people have always gone, well, where's Elvis? This is that kind of level, isn't it? Elvis is still alive. I spotted him in a McDonald's in Salt Lake City.
And my problem at this point is I don't feel like William and Catherine should give the public any more than they initially promised, because then the public realizes that they're dictating their behavior and they have a sort of control over these people that are typically unattainable.
Yes.
And that's what makes them so special, and that's where they need to remain, unattainable.
Yes, exactly right. But that is where, I mean, and to be serious for a moment, we can have this serious conversation without being disrespectful to the royal family. You know, they need to be so careful. I was listening to a conversation today about how good the Queen, the late Queen, was about all of this, Queen Elizabeth II, how very carefully she was making sure that whatever was released by the royal family, whatever was said, whatever image was put out, whatever view was expressed, it was always given with a great deal of care, and it seems as though they just might need to get some of that back.
I mean, but how much do you feel like the Mother's Day photo was a sharp reaction to trying to silence speculation over the Princess of Wales's health? Because that's my argument. I think, yeah, a lot of strategy has been thrown out the door. Let's just shut everyone up and release a cute photo. In theory, that is a great idea. But when you release a photo that has been altered in any way, really, you add additional questions and you fire up the speculation. So I agree with you. Are they trying to be too modern? Are they trying to modernize the royal family too much, and it's negatively affecting the magic that typically surrounds the royal family?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. But I dare say the Sun tonight has also got a leader saying, you know, just move on, get on with it, you know, get a life effectively. And I think we would all share in that particular wish. Time for everyone to get a grip. Kinsey, thank you very much indeed, as ever. Kinsey Schofield there with her take on the latest rumour, the latest report, I should say, this night in the Daily Mirror, which is that there's now an investigation going on at the London Clinic, where it is supposedly where somebody tried to access the confidential files, medical files, of Kate, Princess of Wales, while she was in there in January. Absolutely extraordinary. Before we discuss the BBC, though, I'd like to introduce the former BBC royal correspondent, Michael Cole. Let me get your reaction, Michael, to that breaking story, an extraordinary story that the London Clinic is currently investigating the possibility that somebody in that building, in that place, actually tried to access confidential records of the Princess of Wales. What do you make of it?
Well, if that happened, it was a felony, it was vile, and it was despicable. But if we throw our minds back, Michael, to before Prince George was born, when Princess Kate, who was then the Duchess of Cambridge, was in another hospital nearby, the Edward VII Hospital, with severe morning sickness, a couple of jokers, so-called, on a Australian radio station, rang the hospital, pretending to be, I think, Buckingham Palace, and they were put through to a hapless nurse, a conscientious nurse, who thought she was doing her duty, and she spoke about her patient, and she wasn't a native speaker, she was an overseas person who'd come here to work, and she was highly embarrassed because she did give away some information about their very famous patient. So this sort of thing goes on. That was just malicious stupidity, but this is probably criminal intent with a view to presumably making money. So the London Clinic is probably the most prestigious hospital in this country, in addition to all the famous people you've mentioned. John F. Kennedy had treatment there in the 1940s for a particular illness that he contracted. So it is the go-to place. I've been in there once, but only just for a medical. I know that it was a pretty posh experience. And to think that that has happened to a woman who's really having a tough time and should be given ample space and opportunity to make a full and speedy and complete recovery, it is vile in the extreme. So I do hope that if this has happened, that the culprit has been apprehended and will be suitably dealt with.
Yes. Well, certainly, there's no question that it is an offence to access records, confidential records, in a health situation. But, I mean, no reputable publication in this country would ever touch anything like that anyway, certainly wouldn't publish it. So you can only presume that the person, if they were attempting to do something like this, was doing it at the behest, perhaps, of a foreign media organisation.
Well, that could be, couldn't it? There are people abroad. These people abroad know nothing. They have no sense of responsibility. But that doesn't stop them being prepared to jump like a tiger on a wounded lamb if it suits their purpose. They are irresponsible and they are disreputable, but we won't stop it because we live in a free world, and I and you were very much in favor of free speech. But of course, when you give people something, they will inevitably misuse it. And that's the tragedy of this particular story.
Yes, absolutely right. And what have you made of this kind of craziness that seems to have broken out across social media, across the internet? You know, you and I are old enough to remember the days when you didn't actually have such a thing as social media, didn't have such a thing as the internet, and words spread much more slowly. But it seems to have been turbocharged. This whole mad, crazed world that we now live in has suddenly got even more crazy in the last 2 weeks.
It is actually appalling, Michael. I deprecate it in the extreme. These rumour mills will keep on churning until there is substantial, on-the-record briefing. It doesn't do any good for Kensington Palace to identify friendly individual journalists and give them a briefing that at some future date the Princess of Wales may, in an informal situation with members of the public, divulge something about the treatment that she's undergoing and what really ails her at the moment. That really doesn't do, because it just adds to the tsunami of nastiness, vileness, crackpottery that is going on in social media. Social media, which is a wonderful thing, a wonderful invention, but it's turned into an amalgamation of a piranha pool.
Yeah.
And a cesspit, because people are so vile to each other and they say things that they wouldn't dare to say to people's faces.
Yes.
Well, that is the true mark of the coward. And that's what we're seeing. I would strongly recommend, if I were having anything to do with the Kensington Palace press office, which I don't think has been very effective, for goodness sake, the fake photo fiasco, something like that. Good staff work would have prevented that ever happening. And perhaps maybe because it happened at the weekend, it wasn't prevented. There's always got to be in every PR office an abominable no man, somebody who'll say, no, that's a bad idea. And even to the principals they're working for, even to stop them, save them from themselves. And that clearly hasn't happened. And this is why this rumor mill is going on. It is damaging, and I'm quite sure it's very unpleasant for the princess. I think the sensible thing to do would be for the princess to consult her doctors and to allow a brief official health bulletin. We don't have to go into the details, but a simple statement of what she is suffering would suffice.
Yeah.
And perhaps that, after everything else, would stop the rumour mills, because even with this bit of film yesterday or on Saturday at the farm shop at Windsor, as you've said earlier, people are questioning that. The Sun has come out and answered them quite robustly, as you would expect it to do. But when you look at that piece of film, I mean, I spent half of my professional life, that's 30 years, filming people or being in cutting rooms, looking at faces on film. Did that look to me like two people who knew they were being filmed? Well, I'm afraid it did. So was this contrived? Well, I think the giveaway is that there were no detectives in the picture.
Yes.
Their close support, close protection people were not there. They would normally be there dogging their footsteps and they would be visible. Were they told to, you know, stay in the background because we're going to do this little walk and perhaps a member of the public will see it and record it and perhaps that will scotch the rumours? Well, I'm afraid that won't scotch the rumours. It just feeds them. So I think somebody's got to get a grip in the PR offices at KP and Buckingham Palace and have a plan. There doesn't seem to be a plan at the moment. The old train is rocketing down the rails with nobody on the footplate.
Yes, I think that is a big worry for an awful lot of people. Just to repeat, we're breaking the news here tonight that is in the Daily Mirror, in the paper tomorrow. The London Clinic currently investigating a situation where a member of staff somebody working at the London Clinic may have tried to obtain confidential medical records of Kate, Princess of Wales. We'll bring you more on that coming up a little bit later on when the panel return. But Michael, stay with me though, because we want to move on to the BBC, your alma mater, as the corporation is planning to feature adverts around its audio output in the UK for the first time, to the dismay, quite rightly, of some rival commercial radio stations. The National Broadcaster, which is funded to the tune of £3.8 billion a year, is working on proposals to introduce advertising on podcasts and on-demand radio shows when they are streamed on third-party services such as Spotify. Call me old-fashioned, I'm afraid, Michael, but they shouldn't be on Spotify, should they? What on earth are they doing putting their shows onto commercial operations?
This is utterly deplorable. I worked for the BBC and was proud to do so for more than 20 years, a fifth of its existence. But what I did recognise is that it's the greatest empire builder since Rome at its greatest extent under Trajan in AD 117. It goes into areas it should not be in. It should never have been in local radio.
Yeah,
that should have been left to the commercial world. And what is it doing with its commercial, its BBC radio stations in the provinces? It's killing the local media by its antics. It's gobbling up their stories, right, putting them on the air, and making it life very, very precarious for local newspapers. I've written a chapter in a new book, which is how do we pay for the BBC after 2027? And I've said, you have to destroy it in order to save it. You have to break it up. Now, what you've told the viewers this evening is fascinating. If the BBC really wants to go into commercial radio, then it should hive off radios one and two and become a proper radio station like Capital or LBC or whatever it wants to be.
Or TalkSport Virgin or Times Radio or Talk Radio.
Why not?
All in this building.
If you want to be in the marketplace, be in the marketplace, but don't rely on the punter, you and me, the people paying £169, and that's going up, I think, in April, in this unofficial, unspoken poll tax, which we all have to pay, or I pay. A lot more people don't pay it, of course. They just refuse, and it's a dwindling market.
Right.
And the thing is, Michael, when did you last see anybody under 25 looking at BBC, listening to BBC? They don't. They have their own ways of getting information.
I've got two teenage sons. They don't watch any kind of what you would call linear television anymore. They watch everything pretty much on TV, unless it's a live sporting event. That's all they watch. You know, and more of that is less likely to be on the BBC anyway.
You make the point, you see. A BBC was a wonderful institution. It's had 100 years. It's had a jolly good innings. Now is the time for the umpire to raise his finger and point to the pavilion of past triumphs.
Mm.
It must be broken up. It is unwieldy. It's an empire builder. And it's, shall we say, it's the biggest baby in the pram, and it's pushing all the other babies out.
Well, exactly right. I'd pay good money, by the way, to see you dressed as an umpire standing outside Broadcasting House with your finger like that pointing to the pavilion. I think that would be absolutely brilliant. But the other problem, of course, is that some people have said, oh, hang on, this is only a slight deviation from what they do when they sell their services abroad. For example, if they want to sell their stuff to America, you know, that can be filled with advertising if you're watching it. But they shouldn't really be doing that either, because they're actually operating as a commercial operation based on our investment, and we get no return on that investment.
Absolutely. They've always been cack-handed when it comes to commercialism. I mean, they build a great big thing and a huge big building block called BBC Enterprises. And at that time, Thames Television, if you remember Thames Television, they had four salesmen on commission, and those four salesmen sold more programming than the whole of BBC Enterprises put together.
Right.
Auntie cannot do that sort of thing. And when it tries, it makes itself look stupid. I think it has to go back to basics, slim itself down, concentrate on the core, which is news and current affairs, and quality drama and productions that we can all respect. I mean, I am totally fed up with seeing its appalling dramas, the same 60 actors recycled time after time after time, and things going on long past their sell-by date. It's got to be slimmed down and made more sleek and more competitive. At the moment, it just relies on us to pick up the bill. And every time it spends its money, it wants more. Because, Michael, remember this. This is a unique corporation. It's the only corporation in the world ever set up not to make money, but to spend it.
Yes, absolutely right. Couldn't agree with you more. Michael, great to see you. Great to talk to you, as ever. Thank you very much indeed. Michael Cole, of course. The man of the moment who can talk about the royals with the same alacrity that he can talk about his former employer, the BBC. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming next, though, another horrific XL bully attack where the police had to shoot the dog dead to save the victim. How on earth is this still happening? Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Now, police shot dead an out-of-control XL bully in Battersea in London last night after the vicious creature mauled four men who have all been taken to hospital. My panel are still back with me. Ryan, Emma and Mike are all here. Thanks for coming back in, guys. Let's start off with this terrible XL bully story. Weeks after what was supposed to be the ban, weeks after these dogs were supposed to be muzzled, if you had one, or presumably, you know, sent somewhere into some sanctuary or other in maybe Wales or Scotland. But it's still happening, isn't it?
Yeah, it seems like these stories happening every single week.
Yeah.
And the answer is, you take them off the streets completely, or do you just give them or just muzzle them, and you know, you keep them under close control?
Yeah.
But it seems like the government made a real big song and dance over it on the back of a pretty emotive incident, and you just wonder whether they have to go further, which would anger a lot of dog owners.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, you guys all live in London or in various parts of it. I mean, have you noticed that you don't see so many of them? Because I know there was a period of time, probably towards sort of all autumn of last year, I seem to see an awful lot of these dogs, and I don't see them around as much at the moment. I mean, that's completely anecdotal, but you'd quite often see people walking them, because you'd always just go, blimey, that looks like a terrifically vicious and ferocious
and the
dog.
Idea of muzzling them, to me, and I'm not an animal behaviourist in any, you know, surely that makes them even more aggressive when they do escape, because it's not natural for a dog to be muzzled. I can't imagine it's comfortable.
No.
It really feels, just like Ryan says, it feels as though these dogs actually need to be banned properly.
Yeah.
And yes, rehomed somewhere safe in a sanctuary, but stop the breeding, make it illegal to perpetuate.
Yeah.
I'm not saying kill them all now.
No, of course.
But to stop.
I think the problem they've always had is that, how do you prove that it is in fact a breed that is in fact illegal? Because they had this problem with pit bulls in the past, where they would say, well, if it's a crossbreed, then it doesn't come under the auspices of the breed. Mm. So that, I think, is the problem. But according to this, what eyewitness account, footage from the scene showed one man, this happened about 10 o'clock last night in Battersea, one man hitting the dog with a bike helmet, while another one tried to cover it with a blanket. I mean, it sounds horrific.
Really scary.
And all four of these guys ended up in hospital.
Yeah.
Just shocking. Two people have been arrested on suspicion of having a dog dangerously out of control. But this is the problem. If you've got one of these dogs, they seem to be permanently dangerously out of control.
I suppose then you have to make sure that if they does go through the whole court process, that people are actually punished properly.
Yeah, exactly right. Shocking stuff. Let me take you back to the breaking news we had just at the top of this hour. It's a story in the Daily Mirror about Princess Kate and supposedly an investigation going on at the London Clinic because people or somebody has been trying to access her confidential notes. Very serious story for the London Clinic, this, if they find that somebody was trying to do that.
Yeah, it could well be, from looking at it, a breach of total, you know, patient confidentiality, which if you work in the healthcare service, that's probably the first thing you sign up to actually make sure that people's, you know, conditions are, you know, don't get out there. It's a very personal thing.
Isn't it? This frenzy of activity and the numbers of people who are absolutely obsessed with this story that even after the video came out yesterday, they're not interested.
No,
it's definitely not them. You know, they know everything. It's a bit like, you know, I used to get these people on my late night radio show who didn't believe that, you know, man landed on the moon. They didn't believe that 9/11 was...
Oh, no, and everything you say just feeds the conspiracy.
And everything, you know, well, of course, you must know that this happened, therefore that must be true.
Yeah. But let's not forget that the king is also being treated. He was treated at the London Clinic. Right. This is a potential...
And it's still being treated, we think.
Very secure, should be a very secure hospital. But can you imagine for a moment how vulnerable... I mean, we know that Kate must already be feeling vulnerable and, under attack and under a lot of scrutiny. But the idea that someone... That your hospital, where you've been treated, that they are, that they have your medical records... As any patient, not even a royal patient, not even the most famous woman in the world, because the frenzy in America about Kate at the moment is off the charts.
It is.
But imagine knowing they've got your medical records and that potentially a nurse, as we saw a few years ago when the Australian radio station that Michael Cole was talking about, when the Australian radio station called up the nurses and got private information. I don't know how Kate is coping with all this right now. It must be horrific.
I know, incredible stuff. Of course,
and she's meant to be recovering.
And the front page of The Sun tomorrow has got still yet another Kate story. The pictures from yesterday, from the video, and this is based around the guy who actually filmed it, who is a man by the name of Nelson Silva, who it turns out is a bit of a professional film director. Or something, which of course has fed the trolls even more. Oh, well, of course, he's a professional film.
It's a body director. Double, Mike. It's a
so
body
therefore
double.
He must have set it up and he must have sold it. But basically, he's now saying, "I saw them with my own eyes. Leave them alone." Mike, what do you make of it?
Leave them alone, says the man who filmed.
I mean, it looks pretty much, unless it's generative AI or something like the Dutch, like the Princess of Wales. Sorry, I'm still called the Duchess of Cambridge. It looks like her. It's great to see her out and about in public again. Haven't we done this story to death? That at the end of the day, she's entitled to privacy. Yeah. She recovers. She's due to come back out to public, anticipated in a few weeks anyway. I hope she's going to resume. She's a big asset to the royal family, particularly given the turbulent times they're going through as well. For me, the focus is going to be on the king's health, obviously, the fact he's still performing his duties and carrying on with her as well. But it's good to see her out and about in Windsor there and with her husband by her side.
I mean, incredible, really, isn't it, that this has become such a big story? I wonder if people are just so fed up with everything that this is the only thing they can kind of concentrate on.
They almost see it as...
We can't talk about the serious problem with the country.
It's their soap opera that's a bit lighter.
Yeah, we can't possibly think about the state of the NHS or dreadful state of our border force or anything like that. So let's focus on this.
I presume this is, for a lot of people, this is their escapism. This is their EastEnders Coronation Street. This is the sort of the real-life version of that. But you would sort of just wonder whether the royal family or the household would sort of help themselves by not... they could have staged similar sort of pictures themselves, showing Kate's road
careful.
To recovery.
Be careful what you say. Yeah. I mean, somebody will start staging stuff. I mean, this is the thing. I'm joking, people go, well, they said it on talk TV. It must be true.
But I also think, as well as what you say about the sort of interest, I also think there's a level of genuine love, sort of affection for her and concern behind it. I hate all the conspiracy stuff, and I do think it's verging on bullying. But I think lots of people are also genuinely concerned and kind of interested in her recovery. Yeah. But there's a really good letter in The Sun, which I may quote. Let's just remember that she is the Princess of Wales is a public figure, not public property.
Yes.
And I think that's right, because I've been on shows where people are going, we have a right to know, we pay for them, we have a right to know. And that may be our friend Kev. But I mean, I said, come on, we don't have a right to know.
No.
I actually think Charles and Kate have shared unprecedented personal information. We have a right to know what kind of cancer it is.
Yeah.
No, we don't.
I think one thing was quite interesting over the weekend, a few of the Sunday papers were carrying stories that she will actually explain when the time is right about what has actually happened.
Sure. And you feel
if she wants to,
life will not be improved or disproved by knowing or not knowing.
Yeah, and I think if other people have had the same condition as condition or treatment as what she had, it might help people.
It may well do. But moving on to slightly less serious royal matters, President Trump has given an interview tonight in which he says that if he becomes president, he's going to deport Prince Harry, which I think it's got to be good for a laugh, but I just hope he doesn't bring him back here.
We
don't want him back.
Knocking on the door of Buckingham Palace.
How about we get him sent to Rwanda?
There you go.
Because here's a guy who says he wants to help, people in countries around the world. He wants to have various foundations in Africa. Some of them are not running as well as perhaps they ought to. Yeah, maybe Rwanda's the place for him.
I think it's a perfect place for him. He could help build some of the hostels that we desperately need out in Rwanda.
Of taxpayers' money, though.
I would give him $3,000.
You'd give Harry $3,000.
Yeah. Go away, for sure.
Voluntarily.
Promise never to come back.
It is funny, though, because Trump has talked Trump has talked about draining the swamp and, you know, cracking down on all this stuff.
Right.
We know, I think we know, that Harry lied on those forms.
Right.
If any of the rest of us lied on our forms about cannabis use, we would not be allowed in.
What I found fascinating was the Democrats have actually defended their ability to give him residential status, whatever he's got, because they said, oh, probably the claims in his book were all made up. But I don't think that's really much of a defence.
That's really a defence.
Because if he was sitting there and they were saying, well, you said you took all these drugs and now you're saying you just made it up for a book, what else did he make up?
Exactly.
Very, very interesting indeed. Mark Drakeford, I just want to mention this because of a stupid little thing I'm going to say about his Twitter account. Today, it says on his Twitter page, is Mark Drakeford's last day. We sat down with him to find out a bit more about his time in office. And this is a tweet from the Welsh government. You'd like to think that the Welsh government knew what it was like during his time in office because he was running the Welsh government. But something I noticed today for the first time, which I didn't realise he'd changed, but he did about a year or so ago, he doesn't call himself Mark Drakeford on Twitter. He calls himself Priff Whiny Dog. Exactly, right? Now, apparently that's Welsh for First Minister.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Well, it's Welsh for First Minister. But Priff Whiny Dog.
That's ludicrous.
I mean, isn't that ridiculous?
Just stop.
I mean, I'm loving affection to the Welsh people and they're wanting to continue to speak a language that nobody can understand and cost taxpayers an absolute fortune, by the way, because they publish everything in two languages on the Welsh government front and every road sign is in two languages. But Priff Whiny Dog, I think that's got to be...
The best Twitter handle ever. Yeah, absolutely.
I sent him a message saying, cheerio, Priff. I'm not sure which bit of it that means.
Exactly.
Has he replied yet?
No, funnily enough. He doesn't block me either, which a lot of people do. Should we talk about children as young as 12 are going to be allowed to watch depictions of cannabis abuse in films under new guidelines from the BBFC, the censorship board. But nudity and sex scenes are more likely to be upgraded to a 15. Well, it's bad news for the BBC, isn't it? Because they're always doing shows with nudity in them because they think it's going to be
good for the ratings. It feels like tinkering around the edges when, you know, 12-year-olds have got smartphones and we need to be thinking about the kind of content
Literally.
They access online as well. I mean, you know, OK, you can have a parental lock on iPlayer, but, you know...
Something like 70% of little boys that go into secondary school have already seen online porn.
Yeah.
You know, violent, explicit online porn.
Yes.
Yeah, so a minor depictions of cannabis, you know... Or like... In a TV programme, fair enough, OK, well...
People lying in bed together, you know, you can't watch that.
Yeah, no, exactly right. What about Her Majesty's Revenue Service, HMRC? They've decided that they're going to take off the summer. The thing that I find amusing about this is that they're not going to answer the phones for the summer, but the summer to them begins in April.
Yeah,
so they're going to stop answering the phones as of April the 8th.
At the end of the tax year, when people kind of need HMRC.
Yeah.
April to September.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long summer, that.
That they say that... If you've got a really complex case, that someone will pick up the phone. But I think if you're sending out the message,
how do they know that
exactly.
before you ring?
Exactly.
Does it say complex case? You know,
it sends out a pretty. I can't quite understand why they would particularly do this. I mean, they should have a.
Well, one of their reasons for it, and this is you'd have to work in the public sector to get this. Apparently, one of their reasons for it is that whenever we stop using the phones, when we put the phones back on, we get a real surge of calls.
So we just turn them off.
You think? So it's like, we might as well, like, turn off any access that anybody's got to HMRC, Revenue Customs, and then...
But we have seen this. We have seen companies making it so impossible, like banks, making it so impossible to get hold of anyone.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get automated phone lines where they literally won't even give you a way of getting through. You just keep being directed online.
I had this recently with my local council. I needed to talk to somebody, and it took me literally about 3 days to finally find somebody that I could call.
Yeah.
But even then, they had to call me back. And I had to be in for sort of 3 hours in a window so that they could talk to me. But they were basically telling me for 2 days, we can't put you through to anyone.
So what? Using a chatbot now instead of the phone lines. I mean, you can't ring HMRC as it is already. You know, if they get lots of late self-assessment and fallen revenue, it's only their own
fault. I mean, if it turns out that they haven't been able to sort of find you in time or they start, I think you should just say, well, I'm not paying a fine because you won't answer the phone.
Mm. And what annoys me as well is when you do try and get, you do finally get hold of someone, they say, can you send us an email? We'll have a look into it. It's like, well, that's going to take another two weeks.
Yeah, exactly right. Anyway, listen, we've got much more to do. We've got more from the front pages and inside as well coming up. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. We're going to chat to the panel about all of that. Plus, we're going to find out why people are kicking off in Blackpool during our trip to the world of woke. Do not go anywhere. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk TV. Now, it's time for this.
World of Woke.
Now, Blackpool is famous for many things. The Golden Mile, the Illuminations, the Blackpool Tower, the Pleasure Beach, and miles of sand. It was also once the Stag and Hen Party headquarters of the United Kingdom. More recently, however, things have taken a turn for the worse, and Blackpool is now less likely to be a holiday destination than town in England with the lowest life expectancy, or perhaps the place with the worst drug problems in the country. But fear not, all is not lost, because the council have come up with a plan. Not a plan to clamp down on their growing heroin use or drug dealing, not a plan to reduce the numbers of people dying young on the streets of Blackpool. Nothing so simple for them, I'm afraid. No, they decided to put in some multicoloured crossings to replace zebra crossings. Why? Are they so bored of black and white stripes? Apparently so. But there is a method in their madness. They are part of a number of planned civic improvements to develop a be who you want to be area, where presumably people can be who they want to be, while crossing a particularly garish road crossing that looks like someone has spilled a load of paint on it. According to the Labour-run council, the colours used on the crossing are those of the Progress Pride flag, which, according to them, celebrates inclusivity for the LGBTQ plus community. They've also still got tactile paving surfaces, crossing control push buttons, and tactile cones on the crossing control boxes. No word on whether they're rainbow coloured as well. The council says contractors Uniplay worked through the night to make the colourful transformation in a show of solidarity for a long-established LGBTQ plus community and its history. No word on whether they've spent the same amount of money on fixing the potholes. You'll be pleased to know that rainbow wrap lighting, whatever that is, has also recently been installed on a lamppost in the area. And get this, they are shining bright the message of inclusivity over the streets. Brilliant. You'd think with all the financial problems facing councils this year, the bankruptcy declarations, the removal of bin collectors and other council services, they might have a bit more to worry about, especially in one of Britain's poorest seaside towns. But wait, you'd be right, because they have. The council have also warned that part of Blackpool Beach might be lost forever if they can't get the £11 million from the Environment Agency to combat the ravages of, you guessed it, climate change. Apparently the rising sea levels and more extreme storms mean a part of Anchor's home beach could be at risk. Sounds like a good reason to give them even more public money, because that is the world of woke.
The world of woke.
I mean, I'm sorry, but I just remember when councils used to empty the bins and, you know, make sure that, you know, the streets were reasonably clean. Now they're worried about rising sea levels and making zebra crossings more colourful.
That zebra crossing made me feel a bit queasy.
It's quite weird,
because,
isn't it?
Because when you look at it, you don't quite know where you're going to stand and put your feet, actually.
No. And also, do you know one of the big problems, particularly for the police, actually, is the police horses won't cross them.
Right, yeah.
Because they literally frighten the horses.
And I've never met a single gay person who said that they felt excluded from crossing a regular zebra crossing, or that they felt more included or more accepted or...
I know.
I mean, really,
it's
kind of patronising. It's virtue signalling and it's a waste of money.
And as for, you know, rainbow lighting, I've just got no idea what that is.
I think tactile crossings are important for blind people.
Yeah.
I think that stuff is important because often road surfaces, you don't know, you know, they have pavements that aren't pavements anymore. So they do need that kind of thing, or if you're in a wheelchair, that.
Well, that's practical, isn't it? That's of some use.
That's including
but, I mean,
the
if
white
you happen
people.
To be a blind gay person, you don't care what colour the bloody crossing is, do you?
There's only one zebra crossing improvement I want, just taking one of those electronic piano mats and turning that into a zebra crossing.
Oh, that would be fun.
That would brighten everybody's day.
That would be nice.
That would be
very dangerous.
No one would ever get off it.
Tom Hanks, yeah, exactly right. A couple of big stories that we haven't covered yet. Page one of the Metro, quite important this one, I think, but horrible. Sex offender who sent naked images of himself to a 15-year-old girl and a woman aged 60 has become the first person in Britain convicted of cyber flashing. I mean, what a dreadful thing to do. Unsolicited pictures sent to a teenager, or anybody really. I'm quite glad they've locked this guy up.
This was really bad. The guy had already, so when he was convicted, Nicholas Hawkes, he had already been convicted of sexual crimes in person with a minor, with a child under 16.
Right.
He'd sent these pictures to a grown woman and to a minor. And the thing about cyber flashing, it sort of sounds quite, you know, trivial, but it's really not. And it's usually the gateway for people who then go on and commit crimes in person.
Right.
So it's really, really, it's not just images that make you feel violated and threatened and upset. It's actually the fact that these men almost always go on to actually act out those crimes
But good to see the police are actually doing something.
Yeah, I'm 66
about something
weeks.
Dangerous that does happen, rather than just arresting people for saying, you know, hurty words to people on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, they're actually going after people doing horrible stuff.
This incident, you say, was just a few months ago, was it?
Yeah.
Was it? Yeah, so, I mean, they have acted.
But he was a convicted sex offender.
So, yeah.
I don't know why he wasn't in prison. I don't know why he was allowed online, but we don't know the answers to that.
Yeah, unbelievable. Another one, which is a bit of bad image-making, I suppose, for British Airways. BA cabin crew's racist TikTok video. This is on page 17 of The Sun. They call it exclusive. Two British Airways cabin crew were sacked yesterday for mocking Asian passengers in a video. I mean, what are people thinking? I mean, you make a video, it goes viral, you release it to the public. What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the reputational damage to a company like British Airways.
Yeah.
You know, that you know,
who are struggling enough at the moment.
Yeah, that video does go around the world, and you know, people, you know, rightly deeply offended by it, but they've acted extremely quickly, and they've sacked them.
Yeah, and as indeed they should. Story about the election, which is in The Sun by two of your colleagues.
Yes,
it says Jeremy Hunt yesterday let slip that Britain is heading for an October general election. I was saying earlier that that Harry Cole, political editor, your colleague as well, has said it's going to be October 17.
Yeah, this was Jeremy Hunt this afternoon. He was speaking at the Lords Economics Committee, and he let slip that that talking about when a spending review could take place. And he said, well, if you have an election in October, it means the next government after the election could probably have a spending review by the April. I just wonder whether he said that because Rachel Reeves was making a big speech tonight, and he just wanted to set hairs running a little bit and take the focus away from her. But he perhaps didn't have to say that election date that could be in October, possibly, maybe, but he did. And,
because, again, one of these things, they must know. They must have a date in their mind. It's not like they're going to go into the summer recess and go, well, what did you think? I don't know.
They've got a couple of dates they were working on. They were working on the basis of November the 14th, not that long ago. It does seem to have shifted slightly to October. So I think we're looking at that sort of month, 6-week window.
Okay. And just for good measure, we may as well give him a plug. Harry's doing a new show, Never Mind the Ballots, it says here.
Yeah.
Starts tomorrow, 8 p.m. on the Sun YouTube channel. It's also going out, I think, on Talk TV around about Thursday as well. So a lot going on in the world of politics at the Sun.
Yeah, Harry's going to be in it, Kate, I think, myself and Noah and Jack and Martina,
the
whole team.
We're going to leave time for the Independent Republic, you know, defecting.
And
over
the talk.
There. And to talk as well, of course. Final one, I suppose. We talked about it a little bit earlier. Apparently, there's a red alert now been issued by the UN. Apparently, we're not doing enough to stop the climate change from destroying the planet. I'm going to pay no attention whatsoever to the red alert because I'm sick of hearing them. And apparently, if all this stuff we're doing isn't having any effect, then we might as well stop doing it, right?
Do you know what? The weather feels pretty normal to me. I mean, I know I'm going to be slammed by all the climate change scientists, but it feels quite normal. Some days it's raining, some days it's quite cold, some days it's quite warm.
Yeah.
Today was quite spring-like.
Yeah.
Yesterday was quite wet. It sort of swings and roundabouts.
Exactly right. Couldn't have put it better myself. That's all from us. You've been watching The Independent Republic, Mike Grant. Thank you to all of my guests. I will see you at 8 p.m. tomorrow, only on Talk TV.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.